men fighting in their villages, they are fighting in their towns, they are fighting to, you know, in territory that they are very intimately familiar with. And they're very disciplined, very highly trained, very motivated fighting force.
And can you talk about the sonic booms that you're hearing and how that affects the Lebanese population?
Well, they're terrifying, first of all. It's just, you don't know if it's a sonic boom, and you wait to hear if it was, if there's an explosion that follows the noise. Now, this is also, you know, let's not forget that Beirut has long been terrorized by Israeli overflights, by, you know, Israeli warplanes. All of these things, incidentally, are violations of sovereignty and acts of war. Every year, the United Nations tallies up these violations and presents a report about them. They're usually in the hundreds, sometimes in the thousands, these cross-border violations. So they're not a new development per se, but given the heightened tensions, they are certainly a terrifying sound to hear in the middle of the day, because you just don't know if this is the opening salvo of an expanded war, or if it is just the boom itself and not followed by an explosion.
Are people afraid to use pagers, walkie-talkies, even their cell phones?
Beyond that, people are wondering if perhaps, you know, there were reports that people were disconnecting the lithium batteries in their homes from the solar panels to provide electricity. People were wondering what other devices might explode, what electronics in their home might explode. Some people were telling each other not to use cell phones, but to go back to landlines to communicate. So they're really, you know, this is psychologically, It's broken something, because this is a new sort of development when an everyday object can be weaponized, and it can be weaponized en masse.
Rania Abu Zeid, we thank you for being with us, Lebanese-Australian journalist and author based in Beirut. We will link to your article in the New Yorker magazine, Explosions Across Lebanon. Next up, weeks out from the U.S. election, the Uncommitted National Movement has announced it's not going to endorse Kamala Harris, even as they say they oppose President Trump and that voting for third party is a mistake. We'll speak with the co-founder of the movement. Stay with us.
آلاف الأكف السمري ترتاح على مقبض باب المواعيد أنا زغرودة والدمع على تطريز منديل
Conscious speaker by the Lebanese jazz and folk rock musician Assam Hijali. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We're just 45 days away from the U.S. election. As the Biden administration continues to supply billions of dollars in military aid to Israel, demands for a U.S. arms embargo to Israel remain a key issue among anti-war voters who say they feel ignored by the both major political parties. Now, the Uncommitted National Movement, which pressured by the Democratic Party, pressured the Democratic Party to shift its policy towards Israel and to end the war on Gaza, has announced it will not endorse Democratic presidential candidate Kamala Harris, saying her campaign failed to accept the movement's demands, which also include meeting with Palestinian American families who've had many of their relatives killed in Israeli attacks on Gaza. With less than 2 months to go until the election, Harris has repeatedly defended the Biden administration's support of Israel amidst its relentless war on Gaza. During an interview with on Tuesday with the National Association of Black Journalists in Philadelphia, Vice President Harris was questioned on the issues by reporter Tanya Mosley of WHYY Radio.
You've called for a ceasefire hostage deal and a two-state solution as an end to the war for many months now. And while you've expressed support for Israel to defend itself, a two-state solution and a ceasefire are at odds with what Benjamin Netanyahu has said is their right to defense. If it matters, as you say, how Israel defends itself, where do you see the line between aggression and defense? And our power as Israel's ally to do something.
Okay, a lot to unpack in what you just said. So let's start with this. I absolutely believe that this war has to end, and it has to end as soon as possible. And the way that will be achieved is by getting a hostage deal and a ceasefire deal done. And we are working around the clock to achieve that end. Stepping back, October 7, 1,200 Israelis were slaughtered, but and actually and some Americans, by the way, in that number, slaughtered. Young people who were attending a concert, women were horribly raped. And yes, so I have said, Israel has a right to defend itself. We would. And,
but, Madam Vice President, let me finish. My ask is the difference between aggression and defense.
No, but it's important to put it in context, which is what I'm doing, and I'll get to that. And so how it does so matters. And far too many innocent Palestinians have been killed, women and children. We have seen with horror the images coming out of Gaza, and we have to take that seriously.
That was Vice President Kamala Harris being questioned Tuesday by reporter Tanya Mosley as part of a panel of journalists at the National Association of Black Journalists event in Philadelphia. Meanwhile, Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump said Thursday Jewish voters will be to blame if he loses November's election. Trump stood in front of an Israeli flag as he spoke at the Israel-American Council National Summit. He also used the term Palestinian as a pejorative to describe Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and New York Democrat, and claimed if Kamala Harris wins in November, Israel would cease to exist.
The Jewish people would have a lot to do with a loss. If I'm at 40%, if I'm at 4%, think of it, that means 60% are voting for Kamala, who in particular is a bad Democrat. The Democrats are bad to Israel, very bad. I mean, Chuck Schumer is a Palestinian. But if we don't win this election, Israel, in my opinion, within a period of 2 to 3 years, will cease to exist. It's going to be wiped out. That's what's going to happen.
Trump previously referred to President Biden as a, quote, very bad Palestinian, unquote, in their only presidential debate in June. This all comes as the Teamsters Union said it's not endorsing a presidential candidate for the first time since 1996. The union, which endorsed Biden in 2020, says neither candidate had enough support from their 1.3 million strong membership. For more on the election and the uncommitted movement's announcement, it will not endorse Kamala Harris. We go to Detroit. We go to Michigan, where we're joined by Lexis Edan, co-founder and co-chair of the Uncommitted National Movement. Welcome to Democracy Now! Can you explain the statement that you put out yesterday, Lexis?
Yeah. Hi, Amy. Thank you so much for having me on the show. As many know, Uncommitted put out a statement yesterday where we announced we will not be endorsing a Democratic presidential candidate, Kamala Harris. And in that same statement, we had announced that we are vehemently opposing Donald Trump and that we do not recommend a third party vote. And to put it into a little bit of context, we have been working for months where we, you know, started in Michigan, 1.5 million voter contacts, mobilized over 101,000 people to go to the polls and vote uncommitted as a protest vote against Biden and the administration and their ongoing support for Israel as it relates to the occupation and killing of Palestinians. And what we offered to VP Harris is that if Vice President Kamala Harris is able to do two things, either change policy as it relates to current U.S. policy that backs bombs, or simply does the thing of ensuring and upholding current international and human rights laws as it relates to the way that Israel is violating war crimes, that we would do repeat what we did in Michigan to mobilize our base to go to the polls and vote for her come November. It was an offer we put on the table that was declined by Vice President Kamala Harris and her campaign team. And so because we were not met in good faith, we had to make the decision to not be able to endorse her. And to be clear, an endorsement is an opportunity for us to do the same thing that we did in Michigan, to mobilize our voters. An endorsement means that we are offering something and doing something. And because we were not met in good faith with our policy demands, it is something that we cannot do.
So explain each position, not endorsing Kamala Harris, telling people not to support President Trump or a third party candidate.
Yeah, great question. I think I'll lead with, we have to be very clear, is that there's two options come November at the top of the ticket. It's going to be Vice President Kamala Harris or former President Donald Trump. So keeping that context in mind, we had to make a decision of what that means to grow the power that we've already built within our anti-war organizing movement. And so for us, like I said, an endorsement is meaning that we will mobilize voters to go to the polls and vote for VP Harris. That has to come with policy change. And no policy change came, so it's a decision we had to make to not endorse her. Donald Trump, we have to be very clear, is a direct threat to our society, our civil liberties here and Palestinians back home. As he has mentioned that he plans to annex the West Bank, as he has mentioned that he plans to criminalize organizations here in our own country who are fighting for Palestinian human rights. And then to the third point of not recommending a third party vote, we know that unfortunately a third party vote is not viable in this broken electoral system. And so inadvertently a third party vote would support a Donald Trump victory. And so knowing all this context, we believe that our power lies within our movement, that our power lies within our people, that our power lies in continuing to grow the anti-war organizing movement that we have to truly pressure the Democratic coalition or the Democratic administration to change policy as it relates to its current U.S. policy of backing bombs.
Speaking of third parties, this month, the Council on American-Islamic Relations, CARE, published a follow-up poll that shows Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein ahead of Kamala Harris among Muslim voters in the key swing states of Michigan, Arizona, and Wisconsin. So can you talk about the significance of what this means of not endorsing Kamala Harris?
Yeah. I mean, I think we have to recognize that a lot of people, especially people within the Arab and Muslim community, you know, as VP Harris put it in her speech, we got to put things into context. And the context here is that these communities are communities that are suffering. They are communities that are grieving. And the idea of people going and asking them who you are voting for come November, we've said this repeatedly, is like asking them that question at a funeral. And so we have to keep in context how people are grieving, feeling emotionally. The very same people who came out in 2020 and mobilized very well for Biden, who feels very betrayed by this administration. And so we believe as a movement that it's our responsibility to do three things right in this very moment is, one, educate voters across the country, including Arab and Muslim voters, provide them with voter education on the dangers of Donald Trump. Two, recognize that the genocide is still happening, that we cannot wait till January to shift policy, and that we have to continue to pressure the Biden-Harris administration to change policy immediately to save as many Palestinian lives as possible. And the third thing is to continue to grow our anti-war organizing power with Democratic coalitions across the country. We have to recognize that our power has impacted elected officials speaking up for Palestine as well, from school board members all the way up to congressional leaders that are talking openly about why we need to change our U.S. foreign policy as it relates to backing bombs. And so these people that are talking about voting Jill Stein in third party are people who are suffering. And we believe it is our job to continue to do the organizing work that we have to do ahead of November to educate our voters about what's at stake come November and how we have to grow our organizing power to see long-term policy change to lead to a liberated and a free Palestine.
Finally, your response to Senator Bernie Sanders preparing a joint resolution of disapproval against the planned $20 billion in U.S. arms sales to Israel. He spoke from the Senate floor Wednesday.
Netanyahu's policies have trampled on international law, made life unlivable in Gaza, and created one of the worst humanitarian disasters in modern history. The simple fact is that we must end our complicity in Israel's illegal and indiscriminate military campaign, which has caused mass civilian death and suffering.
We have 30 seconds, Lexis. Your response.
Yeah, I mean, he highlighted it perfectly, is that we are aiding and abetting and indiscriminately killing civilians. And it goes to the point of what we've been explaining in this movement and what we've been trying to get VP Harris and the administration to move on, a sentiment that actually resonates with the majority of Democrats, 77% of Democrats, 61% of Americans, that oppose weapons aids to Israel. When we look at our international law and our U.S. law as it relates to violation of war crimes, this is something we should not be funding. So what we're asking is not outrageous. We're making a very simple request to follow international law and do what's right and create an opportunity to de-escalate what's happening in the region and to really make sure that we're valuing Palestinian lives as much as any other lives.
Lexis Zeidan, I want to thank you for being with us, co-founder and co-chair of the Uncommitted National Movement, speaking to us from Detroit, Michigan. Next up is Donald Trump continues to refuse to admit he lost the 2020 election. We'll speak with filmmaker Michael Primo, who embedded with three Trump supporters around the 2020 election, one of them an insurrectionist who has been sentenced to one of the longest prison terms for participating in January 6th. Stay with us.
Rainbows out in Gaza, from the mountains to Ramallah. My blood mixes with the dirt. I smile despite the overwhelming hurt. Die for you to cry under that Gazan sky. There is no hope for mercy. How many fathers cry themselves to sleep at night, closing their daughter's eyes, kissing one last goodbye. If only I could change the rules of space and time, I would bend the light of day.
Kiss My Wounds by Palestinian American singer Anis. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Secret Service recently announced the next electoral count after the November election is scheduled for January 6, 2025. This time, the event will be classified under the same security level as the inauguration itself. The move follows a request by Washington, D.C.'s mayor and a recommendation by the House Select Committee to investigate the January 6 attack on the U.S. Capitol. This comes as former President Trump dodged a question about his January 6 actions and refused to acknowledge his 2020 loss when he was asked about it by debate moderator David Muir during last week's debate with Kamala Harris.
You were the president. You were watching it unfold on television. It's a very simple question as we move forward toward another election. Is there anything you regret about what you did on that day? Yes, sir.
I had nothing to do with that other than they asked me to make a speech. It would have never happened if Nancy Pelosi and the mayor of Washington did their jobs. I wasn't responsible for security. Nancy Pelosi was responsible. She didn't do her job.
The question was about you as president, not about former Speaker Pelosi.
This comes as a new documentary offers a close-up look at Trump supporters in the run-up to the 2020 election, including members of the far-right group, the Proud Boys. Homegrown follows three right-wing Trump supporters before and after the 2020 election, when they become convinced it was stolen and take to the streets. The film just had its world premiere at the Venice Film Festival. In a minute, we'll speak with the director who embedded with them, including on January 6. But first, this clip from Homegrown that features Chris Gueglin, a New Jersey electrician who's one of the three people the film follows. It follows him as he divides his time between preparing to become a parent and stocking up to prepare for war. This clip is from January 5th, 2021, as he arrives at his hotel room in Washington, D.C. before the insurrection.
Dude, I got so many filters. This is what all this was. I literally have two pair of pants, three shirts and gas masks and body armor. That's, and I had eight bags.
And wear this gas mask if necessary. Holy
and a taser. I think it might be legal. It's floatable. All this is my survival. This is all medical. Trauma, bullet wounds, tampons, because they're great for knife wounds. People are like, oh, we're going to have a civil war. And I'm like, oh, I've been planning for this for 10 years. Are you kidding me? These things are bad, dude. And you're not breaking through them. I don't care if they're from China or not. My wife's from China. She's the best lady I ever met. So I don't care if they're from China or not. You're not breaking through those. And if I would love to see some Antifa, like, just hogtied.
Chris Quaglin has since been sentenced to one of the longest prison terms for participating in the insurrection. For more, we're joined by Michael Primo, director of Homegrown, executive producer of Storyline. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. This is a powerful, rare, behind-the-scenes account of what happened. Talk more about Chris, this guy who ends up, what, being sentenced to 11, 12 years for assaulting a police officer, among other things?
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. So Chris, one of the three protagonists in the film, is an electrician from Jersey who, before 2016, never considered himself political. He said before Donald Trump ran for president, he never paid attention to even local or national elections. But he was so inspired by what he heard coming from Trump that he felt sort of compelled and called to become an activist.
Let's go back to Homegrown, to another clip of Chris Quaglin and his friends in his truck as they drive in a Trump train protest.
There is a lot more patriots in this country than what the mainstream media tells us. You look out here and you'll never see a Joe Biden rally quite like this. There are millions of patriots out there. We will stand down and stand by and wait for the president's call.
Trump 2020, baby!
We should have tied. We should have tied Antifa to the pole right here in the back.
Dude, you tie him like Jesus. Crucify him up there.
Tie him up. But tie him up, not nail him.
Yeah, just tape
so
him.
You could
duct tape, bro. Duct tape. Duct tape.
And with no clothes on.
100%.
No clothes.
You have to, but you leave the mask on.
Yeah, leave his mask on. You don't want him to get a flu, you know? God forbid if he gets a cold.
There's a sheriff.
Pulled over. Not with Trump flags, but.
Not with Trump flags, we're not.
Nah.
If, as long as I wasn't.
You could shoot somebody and you would get pulled over.
He said you could shoot someone here and you wouldn't get pulled over. That was Long Island. President Trump just spoke at the Nassau Coliseum in Long Island this week. Talk about what a Trump train is.
Yeah, Trump train was a kind of an anomaly of the pandemic era campaign, presidential campaign, where in lieu of or in addition to some of the large scale rallies that were happening, people would gather in a long line of cars and drive around a particular area. People may have remembered there was also boat trains where people would gather and do the same thing in a long line of boats and sort of parade around a lake. And it was similar. And they happened around the country.
I want to go to another clip, and this is of Proud Boy Thad Cisneros, an activist from Texas, who you show as he teams up with a Black Lives Matter activist named Jakari Kelly. This is a clip of them together as they drive in another Trump train protest.
Girl, what you doing, girl? What you doing, girl? Black Lives Matter, girl.
We are in a caravan going one direction.
There's some more.
And it's a Patriots Against Racism. That's what it is. Patriots Against Racism. So then, can I flip this around? There we go. So they organized another event, the BLM Utah, and you can see them. And they're being very stunning and brave, and they're flipping everybody off.
But that works vice versa, because when I was in the caravan, the Trump supporters were flipping us off.
No, it's very stupid.
Way more attention than there needs.
Yeah, exactly. Both Jakari and myself are of what I think is a very good opinion, that you should allow the other side to voice their opinion without any kind of reprisal. You know, this is a demonstration of what I would consider to be unity amongst people with the same opinion.
So why not just have American flags?
Well, these guys are Trump supporters. They're voicing their opinion.
But if it's anti-racism, like, what's that?
Oh, my gosh. Trump is not synonymous with racism. Let's not go there, Jakari.
So is this a Trump caravan, or is this supposed to be, like, a patriot caravan?
Oh, I see what you're saying. Because
right.
It's just patriots against racism.
Looks like it's a Trump caravan.
See, at least I'm trying to understand. But can we agree that Donald Trump is not synonymous with racism, please?
I see you said some racist ass. I'll say that part.
We got guys in New York, one of which is married to a black woman with black children. And
that doesn't make you not racist if you have a black family.
I cannot grasp that concept.
No, you still have that little prejudice.
that is complete nonsense to me.
Oh, my God.
That is complete nonsense.
That's like saying a black person can't be prejudiced against a Mexican person.
So that's Proud Boy Thad Cisneros, who now is in jail in Texas, not related to January 6th.
Yeah, he's in jail for aggravated assault unrelated to his political activity.
You're a filmmaker of color. You embedded with these guys, most of them white, but some of them activists of color. Talk about that.
I mean, I think going into this project, I had a vision or understanding of the conservative movement as much more white than what I encountered, and why it was important to include Thad in the film, as well as a couple other sort of minor participants that you see in the background throughout the film, is because they represent this increasing participation of black and Latino people, mostly men, who are sort of feeling inspired by the conservative movement and can increasingly see themselves as foot soldiers in this movement.
I mean, you have a scene in Portland, Oregon. This is after January 6th, where they are shooting up the area. Weapons are a big part of what they do.
Yeah, weapons are absolutely critical, and I think that's also the draw for some people, some men of color, this sort of feeling of power and feeling powerful and being near other people who are sort of reclaiming power, so to speak.
Why did they accept you?
I think it's a good question. I'd love to ask them that question. I think some of these people were generally interested in talking to somebody who may not necessarily agree with everything that they stand for, but was interested in talking to them. And that sort of confused and confounded people and really encouraged folks to try to talk to me in a way that I wasn't prepared for or didn't expect initially.
Have you spoken to Chris since he has been in prison?
I've talked to Chris over—so Chris was arrested in April of 2021, and he was held without bail until his sentencing, which happened earlier this year. And I talked to him a bunch of times throughout his incarceration while he was awaiting trial.
Does he regret what he did?
No, he feels like he's being railroaded and completely sort of jammed up by the system, so to speak, and sees himself as a political prisoner.
Why'd you call it homegrown?
Because I think very often when we talk about these tensions, these divisions, people in the media often refer to other people coming into a place from somewhere else. And we really want to make clear that this is a homegrown issue, a homegrown problem that we need to address.
So you were just at the Venice Film Festival. What's next?
We have about 25 festivals coming up around the United States and Europe. And those festivals will be listed at homegrown.film as they become live.
What do you expect to happen next? January 6th.
I feel like that if the if this was a foreign country, the State Department would issue travel advisories for this fall. So I'm very concerned with the height of sort of violent rhetoric that only seems to have gotten worse since last year. I feel like perhaps on January 6th, we might not see what we did in 2021. But between the election and January 6th, I think we were prepared for an escalation of violence.
Michael Primo, director of the new documentary, Homegrown. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Your roof is leaking. It's your lucky day. Over a quarter of a million Canadians would give anything to be so lucky. But a crisis in affordable housing prevents that. Don't let homelessness assumptions get in the way of homelessness solutions. Go to CanadaCanDoIt.ca. Help the Canadian Alliance to End Homelessness.